Chapter 31. Sabbath, yes, saved him. I took his place, but I lost my train, and it was I who broke the Sabbath. Up to that time I never had broken the Sabbath in my life, and from that day to this, I never have kept it. Oh, I am learning much here tonight. I find I didn't know anything about the American society, that is, I didn't know its chief virtue. I didn't know its chief virtue until His Excellency our Ambassador revealed it, I may say, exposed it. I was intending to go home on the 13th of this month, but I look upon that in a different light now. I am going to stay here until the American society pays my passage. Our ambassador has spoken of our 4th of July and the noise it makes. We have got a double 4th of July, a daylight 4th and a midnight 4th. During the day in America, as our ambassador has indicated, we keep the 4th of July properly in a reverent spirit. We devote it to teaching our children patriotic things, reverence for the Declaration of Independence. We honor the day all through the daylight hours, and when night comes we dishonor it. Presently, before long, they are getting nearly ready to begin now on the Atlantic coast. When night shuts down, that pandemonium will begin, and there will be noise, and noise, and noise all night long, and there will be more than noise. There will be people crippled, there will be people killed, there will be people who will lose their eyes, and all through that permission which we give to irresponsible boys to play with firearms and firecrackers, and all sorts of dangerous things. We turn that 4th of July, alas, over to rowdies to drink and get drunk and make the night hideous, and we cripple and kill more people than you would imagine. We probably began to celebrate our 4th of July night in that way 125 years ago, and on every 4th of July night since these horrors have grown and grown. Until now, in our 5,000 towns of America, somebody gets killed or crippled on every 4th of - July night, besides those cases of sick persons whom we never hear of, who die as the result of the noise or the shock. They cripple and kill more people on the 4th of July in America than they kill and cripple in our wars nowadays, and there are no pensions for these folk. And two, we burn houses. Really, we destroy more property on every 4th of - July night than the whole of the United States was worth 125 years ago. Really, our 4th of July is our day of mourning, our day of sorrow. 50,000 people who have lost friends, or who have had friends crippled, receive that 4th of July, when it comes, as a day of mourning for the losses they have sustained in their families. I have suffered in that way myself. I have had relatives killed in that way. One was in Chicago years ago, an uncle of mine, just as good an uncle as I have ever had, and I had lots of them, yes, uncles to burn, uncles to spare. This poor uncle, full of patriotism, opened his mouth to hurrah, and a rocket went down his throat. Before that man could ask for a drink of water to quench that thing, it blew up, and scattered them all, over the 45 states, and really, now, this is true, I know about it myself, 24 hours after, that it was raining buttons, recognizable as his, on the Atlantic seaboard. A person cannot have a disaster like that, and be entirely cheerful the rest of his life. I had another uncle, on an entirely different 4th of July, who was blown up that way, and really it trimmed him as it would a tree. He had hardly a limb left on him anywhere. All we have left now is an expurgated edition of that uncle. But never mind about these things, they are merely passing matters. Don't let me make you sad. Sir Mortimer Durand said that you, the English people, gave up your colonies over there, got tired of them, and did it with reluctance. Now I wish you just to consider that he was right about that, and that he had his reasons for saying that England did not look upon our revolution as a foreign war, but as a civil war fought by Englishmen. Our 4th of July, which we honor so much, and which we love so much, and which we take so much pride in, is an English institution, not an American one, and it comes of a great ancestry. The first 4th of July in that noble genealogy dates back 7 centuries lacking 8 years. That is the day of the Great Charter, the Magna Charta, which was born at Runnymede in the next to the last year of King John, and portions of the liberties secured thus by those hardy barons from that reluctant King John are a part of our Declaration of Independence, of our 4th of July, of our American liberties. And the second of those 4ths of July was not born, until 4 centuries later, in Charles the First's time, in the Bill of Rights, and that is ours, that is part of our liberties. The next one was still English, in New England, where they established that principle which remains with us to this day, and will continue to remain with us, no taxation without representation. That is always going to stand, and that the English colonies in New England gave us. The 4th of July, and the one which you are celebrating now, born, in Philadelphia on the 4th of July, 1776, that is English too. It is not American. Those were English colonists, subjects of King George III. Englishmen at heart, who protested against the oppressions of the home government. Though they proposed to cure those oppressions and remove them, still remaining under the crown, they were not intending a revolution. The revolution was brought about by circumstances which they could not control. The Declaration of Independence was written by a British subject. Every name signed to it was the name of a British subject. There was not the name of a single American attached to the Declaration of Independence. In fact, there was not an American in the country in that day except the Indians out on the plains. They were Englishmen, all Englishmen. Americans did not begin until 7 years later, when that 4th of July had become 7 years old, and then, the American Republic was established. Since then, there have been Americans. So you see what we owe to England in the matter of liberties. We have, however, one 4th of July which is absolutely our own, and that is that great proclamation issued 40 years ago by that great American to whom Sir Mortimer Durand paid the just and beautiful tribute, Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln's proclamation, which not only set the black slaves free, but set the white man free also. The owner was set free from the burden and offense, that sad condition of things where he was in, so many instances a master and owner of slaves, when he did not want to be. That proclamation set them all free. But even in this matter England suggested it, for England had set her slaves free 30 years before, and we followed her example. We always followed her example, whether it was good or bad. And it was an English judge that issued that other great proclamation, and established that great principle that, when a slave, let him belong to whom he may, and let him come whence he may, sets his foot upon English soil, his fetters by that act fall away, and he is a free man before the world. We followed the example of 1833, and we freed our slaves as I have said. It is true, then, that all our 4ths of July, and we have 5 of them, England gave to us, except that one, that I have mentioned, the Emancipation Proclamation, and, lest we forget, let us all remember, that we owe these things to England. Let us be able to say to old England, this great-hearted, venerable old mother of the race, you gave us our 4ths of July, that we love, and that we honor and revere. You gave us the Declaration of Independence, which is the charter of our rights. You, the venerable mother of liberties, the protector of Anglo-Saxon freedom, you gave us these things, and we do most honestly thank you for them. Americans and the English, address at a gathering of Americans in London, July 4, 1872, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for the compliment which has just been tendered me, and to show my appreciation of it, I will not afflict you with many words. It is pleasant to celebrate in this peaceful way, upon this old mother soil, the anniversary of an experiment which was born of war with this same land so long ago, and wrought out to a successful issue by the devotion of our ancestors. It has taken nearly 100 years to bring the English and Americans into kindly and mutually appreciative relations, but I believe it has been accomplished at last. It was a great step when the 2 last misunderstandings were settled by arbitration instead of canon. It is another great step when England adopts our sewing machines without claiming the invention as usual. It was another when they imported one of our sleeping cars the other day. And it warmed my heart more than, I can tell, yesterday, when I witnessed the spectacle of an Englishman ordering an American sherry cobbler of his own free will and accord, and not only that but with a great brain and a level head reminding the barkeeper not to forget the strawberries. With a common origin, a common language, a common literature, a common religion, and common drinks, what is longer needful to the cementing of the two nations together in a permanent bond of brotherhood? This is an age of progress, and ours is a progressive land. A great and glorious land, to a land which has developed a Washington, a Franklin, a W.M. M. Tweed, a Longfellow, a Motley, a J. Gould, a Samuel C. Pomeroy, a recent Congress which has never had its equal in some respects, and a United States Army which conquered 60 Indians in 8 months, by tiring them out, which is much better than uncivilized slaughter, God knows. We have a criminal jury system which is superior to any in the world. And its efficiency is only marred by the difficulty of finding 12 men every day who don't know anything and can't read. And I may observe that we have an insanity plea that would have saved Cain. I think I can say, and say with pride, that we have some legislatures that bring higher prices than any in the world. I refer with effusion to our railway system, which consents to let us live, though it might do the opposite, being our owners. It only destroyed 3,070 lives last year by collisions, and 27,260 by running over heedless and unnecessary people at crossings. The company seriously regretted the killing of these 30,000 people, and went so far as to pay for some of them voluntarily, of course, for the meanest of us would not claim that we possess a court treacherous enough to enforce a law against a railway company. But, thank heaven, the railway companies are generally disposed to do the right and kindly thing without compulsion. I know of an instance which greatly touched me at the time. After an accident, the company sent home the remains of a dear distant old relative of mine in a basket, with the remark, "Please state what figure you hold him at and return the basket." Now there couldn't be anything friendlier than that. But I must not stand here and brag all night. However, you won't mind a body bragging a little about his country on the 4th of July. It is a fair and legitimate time to fly the eagle. I will say only one more word of brag, and a hopeful one. It is this. We have a form of government which gives each man a fair chance and no favor. With us, no individual is born with a right to look down upon his neighbor and hold him in contempt. Let such of us as are not dukes find our consolation in that. And we may find hope for the future in the fact that, as unhappy as is the condition of our political morality today, England has risen up out of a far fouler since the days when Charles I. ennobled courtesans and all political place was a matter of bargain and sale. There is hope for us yet. At least the above is the speech which I was going to make, but our minister, General Schenck, presided, and after the blessing, got up and made a great, long, inconceivably dull harangue, and wound up by saying that inasmuch as speech-making did not seem to exhilarate the guests much, all further oratory would be dispensed with during the evening, and we could just sit and talk privately to our elbow neighbors and have a good, sociable time. It is known that in consequence of that remark 44 perfected speeches died in the womb. The depression, the gloom, the solemnity that reigned over the banquet from that time forth will be a lasting memory with many that were there. By that one thoughtless remark, General Schenck lost 44 of the best friends he had in England. More than one said that night, "And this is the sort of person that is sent to represent us in a great sister empire." About London, address at a dinner given by the Savage Club, London, September 28, 1872. Reported by Moncure D. Conway in the Cincinnati Commercial. It affords me sincere pleasure to meet this distinguished club, a club which has extended its hospitalities and its cordial welcome to so many of my countrymen. I hope, and here the speaker's voice became low and fluttering, you will excuse these clothes. I am going to the theater. That will explain these clothes. I have other clothes than these. Judging human nature by what I have seen of it, I suppose that the customary thing for a stranger to do when he stands here is to make a pun on the name of this club, under the impression, of course, that he is the first man that idea has occurred to. It is a credit to our human nature, not a blemish upon it, for it shows that underlying all our depravity and God knows, and you know we are depraved enough, and all our sophistication, and untarnished by them, there is a sweet germ of innocence and simplicity still. When a stranger says to me, with a glow of inspiration in his eye, some gentle, innocuous little thing about twain and one flesh, and all that sort of thing, I don't try to crush that man into the earth, no. I feel like saying, let me take you by the hand, sir, let me embrace you. I have not heard that pun for weeks. We will deal in palpable puns. We will call parties named King, Our Majesty, and we will say to the Smiths that we think we have heard that name before somewhere. Such is human nature. We cannot alter this. It is God that made us so for some good and wise purpose. Let us not repine. But though I may seem strange, may seem eccentric, I mean to refrain from punning upon the name of this club, though I could make a very good one, if I had time to think about it a week. I cannot express to you what entire enjoyment I find in this first visit to this prodigious metropolis of yours. Its wonders seem to me to be limitless. I go about as in a dream, as in a realm of enchantment where many things are rare and beautiful, and all things are strange and marvelous. Hour after hour I stand spellbound, as it were, and gaze upon the statuary in Leicester Square. Leicester Square being a horrible chaos, with the relic of an equestrian statue in the center, the king being headless and limbless, and the horse in little better condition. I visit the mortuary effigies of noble old Henry Villa, and Judge Jeffreys, and the preserved gorilla, and try to make up my mind which of my ancestors I admire the most. I go to that matchless Hyde Park and drive all around it, and then I start to enter it at the Marble Arch Dash and am induced to change my mind. Cabs are not permitted in Hyde Park, nothing less aristocratic than a private carriage. It is a great benefaction, is Hyde Park. There, in his handsome cab, the invalid can go, the poor, sad child of misfortune, and insert his nose between the railings, and breathe the pure, health-giving air of the country and of heaven. And if he is a swell invalid, who isn't obliged to depend upon parks for his country air, he can drive inside if he owns his vehicle. I drive round and round Hyde Park, and the more I see of the edges of it, the more grateful I am that the margin is extensive. And I have been to the Zoological Gardens. What a wonderful place that is! I never have seen such a curious and interesting variety of wild animals in any garden before, except Abbey. I never believed before there were so many different kinds of animals in the world as you can find there, and I don't believe it yet. I have been to the British Museum. I would advise you to drop in there sometime, when you have nothing to do for 5 minutes if you have never been there. It seems to me the noblest monument that this nation has yet erected to her greatness. I say to her, our greatness as a nation. True, as he has built other monuments, and stately ones, as well. But these he has uplifted in honor of 2 or 3 colossal demigods who have stalked across the world stage, destroying tyrants and delivering nations, and whose prodigies will still live in the memories of men ages after their monuments shall have crumbled to dust. I refer to the Wellington and Nelson monuments, and the Albert Memorial. Sarcasm. The Albert Memorial is the finest monument in the world, and celebrates the existence of as commonplace a person as good luck ever lifted out of obscurity. The library at the British Museum I find particularly astounding. I have read their hours together, and hardly made an impression on it. I revere that library. It is the author's friend. I don't care how mean a book is, it always takes one copy. A copy of every book printed in Great Britain must by law be sent to the British Museum, a law much complained of by publishers. And then every day, that author goes there to gaze at that book, and is encouraged to go on in the good work. And what a touching sight it is of a Saturday afternoon to see the poor. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.